and everyone. I'm Tom Donovan, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi,
howdy. This is the regular Friday evening meeting of the Grapevine Speakers Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. After a moment of silent meditation, will those please turn off the cell phone? Let's see here. Silent meditation, will those who wish to please join me in a serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, everyone. It's time for our main speaker, and I'd like to introduce Tina.
Thank you. My name's Tina, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here and be sober today. And welcome to anybody who's new or relatively new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you, Bud, for making sure I got my certificate. I've run a day late and a dollar short all my life. And so, as I said earlier, my birthday is on the 10th day of October, 1984. And I've got 21 years, 3 months, 2 weeks, and 1 day. And that absolutely amazes me. You know, I remember when I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous and I walked in here and I couldn't conceive of going a 24-hour period without a drink or a something. And I know I had about maybe a week or so sober, and I was really physically sick, and I didn't feel good at all. And every time I would drink coffee, I would throw it back up into my mouth and swallow it back down. And I couldn't eat, and I just felt horrific. And I was sitting in the Alano Club waiting for another meeting, and this little guy named Singin' Sam came up to me. He came in, he was going to the meeting, and he was about yay high, and he had come out of Terminal Island prison. He did years and years in Terminal Island in San Pedro, and he was pardoned and freed and let go when he shouldn't have been, and he was a longtime member in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came right up to me, and he looked at me, and he goes, "How you doing, honey?" You know, everybody used to talk like that back then. "How you doing, honey?" And I looked at him and I cried. He touched my hand and I burst into tears. And I told him, "Sam, I don't think I can do this, not another minute." And he just held my hand and he looked me in the face and he said, "You can hang tough for just one day, can't you, baby? Anybody can hang tough for just one day." And that little old man looking me in my eyeballs made me believe that he believed I could stay sober for just one 24-hour period, when I was absolutely certain that I was not going to be able to draw another breath without going and getting a drink. And somewhere in my mind, I thought, if Sam thinks I could do this, maybe I could just hang on till after the meeting, you know? And somewhere in me could not fathom coming back in and telling Sam that I didn't hang tough for that 24-hour period. So I just stayed through that meeting, and by the time it was over, I didn't want to drink anymore. And you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm supposed to, I had a triple coffee, so I'm going to hyperventilate, pass out, but I'm sure somebody in here will be able to fix me. always works like that, I swear. But, you know, I'm supposed to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I can tell you that before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous, before I ever drank, I desperately needed to drink. You know, I felt irritable, restless, and discontented from the time that I can remember all the way back to the furthest reaches of my memory banks. When I was this little, I felt different than you, and, you know, not pretty enough, not smart enough, and not good enough. And I was certain that everybody was looking at me, and I was found wanting. And why a little 4 or 5-year-old would ever believe that is beyond me, but that's the way that my mind worked from the time that I could remember. And I used to do bizarre, crazy things when I was a little girl. And I remember being 5 years old in kindergarten and going to school and wanting somebody else's show and tell toy more than I wanted my own, so I took it. And the next day, my 5-year-old brain knew I was going to be in serious trouble, so I ditched kindergarten and went and hung out at the park. And you know, I needed a drink that day, and I didn't know that. And I went back to the babysitter's house, and the neighbor caught me at the park, and I was in all kinds of trouble. I had to take the toy into the principal and tell him what a rotten piece of crap I was, and I got in all kinds of trouble, and I was just humiliated and mortified from yay high. And I knew in third grade my teacher hated my guts. She was this little hunchback woman named Miss Goldstein. You know how sometimes you just remember those teachers? And she impacted my life. I knew this woman hated me. And I climbed up in my mom's closet and I stole an antique diamond ring that used to belong to my great-grandmother and I gave it to the woman for Christmas. Because I thought if I gave her something special, she'd just be a little bit nicer to me. And I just knew she hated me. And I would do anything to get your attention and make me feel like I was okay just for a minute because I didn't have that ability on my own. I used to do bizarre things like empty out all the antique coin books with the buffalo nickels and, you know, those really old coins that my mom and dad had been saving for years and years. And I'd steal them a nickel and a dime and a quarter at a time and take them to school and buy everybody ice cream on Friday for 15 cents. Because I was certain if I bought you an ice cream sandwich next Monday, maybe you'd smile at me when I went to school. And I didn't realize that I just needed a drink. All of those days, I just needed a drink. And I didn't have alcohol in my life. And I didn't have anybody in my life that I could recognize the release that they got in alcohol. And I just felt like crap, you know. I was raised in Manhattan Beach, and in my mind's eye, as a young girl going into middle school, I looked at all of these girls, and they had blonde hair and blue eyes, and they looked like Farrah Fawcett and Charlie's Angels, you know. And I looked in the mirror and saw Pippi Longstocking. I had long, stringy red hair and buck teeth and freckles, and I just didn't fit. No matter what I did, I couldn't fit. And in seventh grade, my friend and I decided to ditch school, because it worked so well the first time. And we went to her mom's house and we dove into this bottle of scotch. I remember putting a drink of scotch in my mouth and I hated the taste of that stuff, you know. And I put my tongue over the mouth of the bottle and I'd make my throat move to make her think I was drinking because I didn't like it at all. And I watched Carrie and she drank a little bit of that scotch and she started giggling and her face got a little pink and she looked like she was having so much fun, and I intuitively knew I wanted what she had, and I uncovered the mouth of that bottle and slugged that scotch down like a pro, I don't remember too much after that. We guzzled a lot of that bottle, and by the time the day was over, we had drank just about all of it. I do remember vaguely puking all over her mother's living room, just kind of what I did. And you know, my mom caught me ditching school again. The school had called, and she came banging on the door because she just knew right where I was. And we jumped out the back window with the bottle of scotch, and we were off and running. And we were climbing the water tower and hiding in the city yard and going through your backyards. And it was the grandest, most awesome adventure. I felt alive and free, like I had found the magic elixir to life. Everything I ever wanted, I found in that scotch bottle. You know, by 4 o'clock that afternoon, we kept drinking all day, and I don't remember parts of it. And by the time 4 o'clock rolled around, I knew I couldn't go home, and I was in more trouble than I'd ever been in my life. And I intuitively knew that the only logical solution to the problem that I was in was to take Carrie's 9-year-old little brother and run away from home. So I did. You know, it's funny. About a year ago, I was telling one of the girls that I sponsor that I was going to go somewhere and speak. She goes, "Tell that story where you kidnapped the 9-year-old." And I was like, "Yeah!" Leave it to a newcomer. I never thought of it like that, you know. But I had just read that book, The Other Side of the Mountain, you know, where the little kid Sam goes and he's living off the land and he gets a hawk and it seemed like just a grand adventure, and I wanted to do that. So I took Sean, and we stole a bike from the high school, and I put him on the handlebars, and we went off riding. About 11 o'clock, I had made it to East L.A., and it was dark, and Sean was crying, and we were cold and hungry, and he was just a whiny little thing. We ditched the bike in the trash can and called the cops, and they came and got us and took us home. And I had devastated my mom. I remember her and her friend coming to pick me up, and my mom couldn't even drive. You know, she was the sweetest little woman you'd ever meet in your life. And she was sitting in the passenger seat just crying, and her friend was driving. And you'd swear, I don't know why we didn't wreck, because Carol was turned around cussing me and hitting me in the back seat all the way from East L.A. back to Manhattan Beach. You know, I was just so busted, and I never wanted to see that look on my mom's face, but I can tell you that I saw it over and over and over and over again until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time it seemed like it got a little bit worse and it cut a little deeper and I did something just a little bit more dastardly, you know. So anyways, that's kind of what alcohol did for me, and I tell that story because every time I drank, that kind of happened to me. I loved to throw up when I was drinking, and I threw up just about every time I drank. And normally what I would do is chug a lot straight until I puked, and then I would laugh and make everybody think it was funny, and now that I got that out of the way, we can get on with the business of drinking. And I just loved alcohol. I woke up the next morning, I was so sick. And I was in so much trouble, and I so couldn't wait to do it again, you know. Not necessarily the ditch the school part, but that's, you know, I just wanted to do it again. In that drink of scotch, I got that release that I had looked for all of my life. You know, the one where you pick up a drink and you just go, like my hair straightened a little bit, you know. My boobs grew 2 cup sizes, and I intuitively knew that supermodels were tall and red hair was the new in thing to have, and what you thought of me didn't matter just for a minute, and I loved the release that I got from alcohol. My skin stopped crawling, and then the next morning it was crawling again, and I just needed to do that again. And, you know, I love the part in the doctor's opinion that talks about the phenomenon of craving, because I get that when I drink, and it seemed like every time I picked up a drink, I would lose the ability to tell you what I was going to do, where I was going to go, how much we were going to drink, whether I was going to show up to work or not. I just couldn't tell you. I would pick up a drink, and I would be off and running until I was done. And it was really unpredictable from the very first time that I drank. I went through a rehab when I was in the military, and I'll get there in a minute. But this little counselor's name was Mike Lenahan. He said, "Did you ever have a memory lapse as a result of your drinking?" And I was 18. He was another one of those little old guys. And did you ever have one of those? And I would tell him, everybody I knew has had a memory lapse as a result of their drinking. I was 18 years old, and I was in trouble. And everybody I know blacks out. And he goes, "Then everybody you know is an alcoholic." And I just thought that was the most preposterous thing that I had ever heard in my life. Look, this is a stupid little man trying to tell me some stuff. You know, but I continued to drink through junior high and into high school, and I can tell you that I drank my way into and out of everything good, right, and proper in my life, and I drank myself into and out of everything bad and improper in my life, and anything that got in the way with the way that I wanted to party left. And so by the time I was in ninth grade, I couldn't predict whether I was going to show up to school or not. Most often, my mom would kick me out of bed and kick me out of the house. So I was up, and I would go to school, and I would go to the bleachers or the wall or the parking lot or, you know, the place from your high school. And I would do what I did there, and I would have to leave before my first period class because I was too buzzed to show up. And I had every intention of coming back around snack or third period or something. I just needed to mellow out a little bit so I wouldn't get in trouble, and then I'd go back to school, and I just never made it. And going into the 10th grade, I was shy a couple credits. I didn't have any. I think I had 5 from a driver's ed class or something. But, I just couldn't show up on a regular basis. And I got incompletes and all my stuff. I failed everything I ever took. And I was going to continuation school in 10th grade. And I was doing the same thing there. I couldn't show up. I'd show up drunk and didn't care because it was continuation school and it was all right. And, I'd do unmentionables in the quad or in the bathroom and smoke things I wasn't supposed to smoke. And I would stay there, but I would not do what I was supposed to do. And halfway through my sophomore year, my counselor called my mom into the office and suggested that I take the GED because I just wasn't going to make it going to school. And I thought it was a great idea. You know, there's a part in the book that says we think we can float above the rest of you on our brain power alone. And that was me. I just thought I was hip, slick, and cool, and intelligent, and I could do anything I wanted to do. So I took this test in the 10th grade, and I graduated. And I had every intention of going to college because high school was just kind of boring. You know, it wasn't the place for me. And it was the late 1970s, and that movie Animal House had just come out, and I thought I was going to go major in toga parties and have a great time, and my mom was going to leverage her home in order for me to do that and pay for my tuition. It didn't work out that way. but it was a good idea, you know. I went to El Camino College, and I did the same thing there that I did at all the schools that I went to. And I hung out with the wrong people. I used to think they were the bad influence on me, and if I could just stay away from them, maybe I would be all right. And today I look back and realize I was the bad influence. It had nothing to do with them. I was the one your mom said, stay away from that kid, she's trouble. And because I was, you know, and I didn't mean to be. That's the funny thing. With everything in me, I wanted to be a good kid. I wanted to make my mom proud. I wanted to bring home straight A report cards so she'd go, I love you, Tina. You're a good daughter, and I'm proud of you. And she never said that. I never gave her reason to say that. And sober, I was like, I hate that woman. She never told me she was proud of me. Well, duh. You know, she says that now. She says funky things that are just beyond my comprehension, like, you're a good mother, honey. And, you know, where does that come from? There's no way to get from where I was to where I stand today except through you guys, you know, and I know that. And that's the one thing that I want to remember on a continuous basis for the rest of my life, that without you guys, I'm nothing, you know. That's one of the things. Neil and Maria were some of our friends that lived in Hollister when we moved up here from Southern California, and that was one of the things that Maria and I talked about a lot was, you know, don't leave before the miracle happens, and don't leave after the miracle happens either. Because when I'm not in here with you guys, the miracle stops. My spirituality goes out the window. I'm much easier to anger, and I'm kind of easy to anger anyway, so I need all the help I can get, you know. And as long as I stay in here with you guys, I got a chance. The great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new in here, is that what we do is we speak the language of the heart, and it's just one drunk talking to another, and we save each other's lives in here, you know. And that wasn't what I thought was going to happen when I came in here, but that's what I found. Anyways, I finished high school and I went to college, and I was getting in a lot of trouble. I ran away from home every other week for a month or two, and, you know, my mom was consistently wondering whether I was dead or alive and had private investigators looking for me, and I just thought I was having so much fun, you know. I'm free. I can do anything I want. You can't tell me what to do. It's my life. I'm not hurting anybody but me. Shut up. And that's the way that I thought. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I read the book, and it tells me that we're selfish and self-centered, and that's the root of our trouble. And I was just appalled. You know, how could you say such a thing to me? But anyways, I had gotten this really great job. I was 17 years old, and it was right down my career path. I thought it was really going to go somewhere. I was working the drive-thru window at the Burger King in Redondo Beach. And I was hanging out the window drinking and smoking with a friend of mine in the car in the drive-thru, you know. And I turned around, and there was a Marine Corps recruiter standing at the counter waiting to get his lunch. And I was kind of not in possession of all of my faculties. And I informed him that I had always wanted to join the Army. And if you've ever known a Marine, it didn't go over very well. But, you know, I was 17 years old. I didn't know what their uniforms looked like. He was just standing there all made up and whatever. And he ended up with my phone number because he was cute or something. And and he called me every morning at 7 o'clock. Every morning at 7 o'clock. And some mornings I wasn't home yet. Some mornings I had just gone to bed. Whatever the case, 7 o'clock was not a good time to call on my house. And I went down to his office one day just to shut him up, you know, to get him to leave me alone. And and he goes, oh, so you don't have a diploma, and you have a GED, and you're 17, and you're blah. And he made me feel so horrible. Well, we're going to take you over to the Navy office, because you can't be a Marine, honey. So, of course, I had to be a Marine. But, you know, I didn't get into the Marine Corps, thank God. But December 21st in 1981, I did find myself in Navy boot camp in Orlando, Florida. And, you know, it's funny, I got off the bus at 11 o'clock, we were drunk, we flew to Florida with a couple girls, and they were screaming at us and taking my stuff and up in my face, and I thought, oh my God, there's just been the hugest mistake that ever could have been made. And as soon as morning rolls around and I'm able to talk to somebody in charge, I'll be able to explain my way out of this and they'll let me go home. No. That didn't happen. I sat in the recruits and processing barracks for a couple of weeks until January. I can tell you that I got in trouble in boot camp for drinking during our work week. I was drinking beer in the vegetable prep room. And I got the division sidewalk. I got almost got set back, almost didn't get to graduate with my company. I met my commanding officer, and I was busted at 17. And I stood there, and I was remorseful and regretful and full of guilt and shame. And I had done something I really didn't want to do. I kind of liked what I was doing, you know. After the thought of they're not going to let me leave and I'm going to settle in and do what they want me to do, it was kind of all right. And I don't know how come, maybe I reminded him of his daughter or something, and he let me go. And I did this division sidewalk. It was like 11 hours of brutal rifle training, and it was ugly. But I graduated with my company, and my mom came to my graduation, and I was just full of myself, you know. It was the first time in my life ever I had completed something all the way through, and my mom could show up and go, wow. And she came, and it was good. I went to Pensacola, Florida for my training. I was going to be a cryptologic technician, which is naval intelligence. And they were running around trying to give me all these security clearances, and I was leaving base and drinking on duty, and I got in trouble, and I left base and got in a wreck on the 3 Mile Bridge, and I met my commanding officer. I did a couple weeks in the restricted barracks. They took a lot of my money. I almost didn't get to graduate. Blah, blah, blah. But I did. And, you know, all of my life I just kind of squeaked by and pulled it off. And after that they sent me to Adak, Alaska, which I really pissed somebody off. It's an Aleutian island out towards the Kamchatka Strait off of the coast of Russia. And in 1981, that's where they sent people in naval intelligence. It was Cold War era, and we were over there spying. And, you know, for lack of a better term. And I was drunk. I was just drunk all the time on the island. I would do insane, bizarre things like go out looking for the party and lay down in the middle of the road because I couldn't find it. And the next car that would come by would stop and pick me up. And then we would go. And it worked a couple times. By the time I left the island, they would drive around me and leave me laying on the ice. but, you know, it was just a small island. And word gets around kind of quick. I drank a lot on that island. I went to CAC counseling. I had my first intervention. I was put on Anabuse and drank on it a couple times. And if you haven't done that, I would highly suggest that you skip it. It's ugly. It's really ugly. I remember walking down the hall, and my friend was on Anabuse too, go figure. And he had a six-pack of Heineken, and I figured we were going to experiment. And I drank half of a Heineken and crawled down the stairs and turned like this color and threw up my toenails for 12 hours or so. And, I didn't die, but I wished I would have. I mean, just for hours and hours, it was miserable. And then I showed up with splotches all over my face to counseling and told him I thought I had the chicken pox. Because that's how my keen alcoholic mind worked, you know. I was sent to Anchorage, Alaska, and I spent a couple of weeks in the psych unit at the Air Force Hospital over there at Elmendorf. And I love it when we read Chapter 5 and it says accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. And I want to know how come they didn't say accepting involuntary commitment to asylums, because I didn't want to be there and I didn't volunteer for that, but I stayed anyway. They sent me back, and a month or two later, I was on my way to rehab, and by now they were crushing my Anabuse tablets and putting them in water and making me drink it because they caught me spitting the tablet out. And we went to a Phillies game one day, and my friend and I decided we were going to experiment, and we sucked down half of a big beer at Philly Stadium, and it was April, and it was unusually hot in Philadelphia, and we were watching them play some game. I don't remember what team was there, but I turned about the color of your sweatshirt and spray puked 5 rows of Philly Stadium, and I told you I like to throw up. I was quickly discharged from that alcohol rehab program. I didn't finish it. I can't figure out why. I've tried, but I just can't quite fathom. But anyways, they sent me over to the naval station for a separation. And I remember leaving there. We had been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember thinking, I'm going to go to AA. I'm going to go to that neighborhood group over there. I'm going to ask this nasty wench named Alice to sponsor me, and I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to petition my commanding officer, and I'm going to save my career. I love being in the Navy. I love my job when they let me do it, and I just want to do this. And I walked out of the rehab over into the naval station, and by noon I was at the EM Club pitching quarters and drinking beer, and that was the last thing on the planet that I wanted to do. And I spent from July of 83 to October of 84 chasing that. and doing every single rotten, nasty thing that I ever could think of that separated me from you guys. When I came in here, I said, I'm 20 years old, I can't be an alcoholic. I've never been to jail, I can't be an alcoholic. I haven't had a DUI, I can't be an alcoholic. Well, we used to call them 502s. I've never done that drug, I've never put it in that orifice, nor have I ever made extra ones, and so I can't be one of you. And by the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had done every single one of those things that separated me and crossed every one of those moral boundaries and barriers that I said I would never go over. And I was living in this little two-seater MG midget. It was like a little mobile townhouse. My friend calls it a roundabout townhouse. But I had a trunk in the trunk with all my stuff in it, you know, and I was living in this car, and there was nobody left in my life. You know, I'd go into the grocery store and rip off whatever I thought I would need, and I stole lots of liquor because that's the only thing I wanted. And I would just sit in that car and drink. And I would go somewhere looking for you, and I would find you, and then you would go out the back door over there and leave me standing there. And I'd go over there, and then you'd go out that door and go back over there. And I just was chasing you at the end, and nobody wanted to be around me, and had been that way for a little while. But I was sitting in this little car, and I had a big bottle of vodka on the seat next to me. And I swear, just like he was sitting next to me, I heard this little counselor at my rehab tell me, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk. And I could have sworn that Jim was sitting there. I mean, his voice was that vivid. And that was the last thing he said to me as I was leaving that treatment program to go over to the naval station in Philly. And I got out of the car and I called Alcoholics Anonymous because that's what he told me to do, you know. If you ever want to do this, if you ever want to get sober, call 411, call Alcoholics Anonymous. Just tell them you're a drunk and they'll do anything they can to help you. And I thought, nah. But I called him anyway because I was out of answers. For the first time in my life, I didn't have any more answers, you know. And this little guy named Sam picked up the phone at central office and he told our manager, Eunice, we got a live one here. Let's send her to Birch. And I don't know how come Sam knew, you know. I thought I put on my best, I'm okay voice. My name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic and I'm looking for a meeting. And he knew and he sent me over to this Alano Club called the Southwest Alano Club in Hawthorne, California. And I walked into this 5:30 meeting. I'd gone to the grocery store and stolen a pad of paper and some pens so I could go in and copy the steps down and get whatever pertinent information I thought I might need from you guys and then I was going to be able to leave. And I walked in, I weighed 120 sucked up pounds, my eyeballs were sunk in the back of my head and my skin looked the color of your sleeves and, you know, I just didn't feel too good. I had just enough bile in my hair to pass as highlights and, I had a big hole in the ass end of my jeans and, you know, it worked for me. That way all the men in the room would look there instead of here because if you looked in my eyes, you just knew nobody was in there. And I walked into this room and I was so afraid of you. I was so afraid of you. I swear to God, everybody in the room looked like Bud tonight. Only they weren't so well dressed. You know, and I walked in there and I thought, oh my God, I was 20 years old and I couldn't fathom a life without alcohol. And I walked in and I inconspicuously sat in the front row of the table right underneath the steps. And I started writing them down and this woman came up and scribbled across my pad of paper. Having admitted to our innermost selves we're real alcoholics, this is the first step in recovery. And I just wanted to hit her. You know, well, she messed up my paper and I was trying to write really pretty and she invaded my personal space and I didn't want anybody to notice that I was there. I just wanted to kind of hang out and soak it up for a minute, you know. And she came up to me and she told me crazy things like, just don't drink, honey, and it'll be okay. And for the last 21 years, I've told her crazy things and she said, just don't drink, honey, and it'll be okay. I'm like, are you not listening to me, woman? You know. This is what's going on. Well, you know, honey, on page 52 in the big book. But that's what I got in here. You know, just go to a meeting, honey, and don't drink, and it'll be okay. And by next week, I forgot what that thing was, and I got a new one I'm coming at her with, you know. They told me to get a sponsor, and they told me that the women work with the women and the men work with the men. So I got a sponsor named Paul Matson, and he was absolutely wonderful. You know, I just was one of those that couldn't follow direction really well, and I didn't want anything to do with the God in your program, and Paul didn't either. And he had been sober about 14 years, and he loved me. No matter what I did, he just loved me. And I worked for him at his gallery, and we went to 3 meetings a day together, and he fed me, and he never, ever, ever did anything improper. He never touched me inappropriately. And he was the first man in my life ever that I had been close to that had done that for me. And he would just touch me and let me know that everything was okay. And he loved me and didn't want anything out of me. And I had never had that before. And when I opened my eyes and looked around Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized there were a lot of people in the room that were doing that for me. You know, and most of them were the guys that looked like butt. And you know, I was a little crazy and full of Tigger kind of energy, and I just bounce in and punch you to say hi instead of hit you, or plop on your lap at the noon meeting, or, you know, we don't want that here. You can't act like that. I would have had to leave, you know. There were some people around that used to say bizarre things to me, like, I spilled more down my shirt than you ever drank. And, you know, obviously the only intelligent comeback to that was, if you'd got it in your mouth, you would have got here a little quicker. but I like to say rude things, because they told me I couldn't talk about chemicals when I came in here. So what I told them was that they were detoxing me off of things that they couldn't pronounce. And they didn't like hearing that too much. But, you know, I'm a firm believer in the steps and the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the one great thing is if I come in here no matter what I did, and I'm a drunk, I get to stay here. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. And when I was brand new, I used that extremely defiantly. Like, I'm an alcoholic, and I get to be here because I say so, and there's nothing you can do about it. And my friend Marshall pulled me aside one day, and he goes, you know, honey, I did a lot of that other stuff too, but when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I just talk about alcohol, and I say I'm an alcoholic, because that's what they can all relate to. And I went, oh. So, you know, and he goes, and I can relate with them, and they can relate with me, and they just kind of like it that way, and it stays easier. And I went, okay. But it wasn't because somebody said, you can't do that, otherwise I would have done it. You know, because that's how we come in here. You know, it says in the big book that we're undisciplined, and I was so incredibly undisciplined. I didn't want to do what you told me to do, you know. Paul didn't make me work the steps, but as I got increasingly uncomfortable, he'd, like, open the book, you know. There was a little lady named Helen around that would just sit in the meeting rooms with me in between meetings, and she'd read the book to me. And she'd go, you know, honey, it says right here, we're 100 men and women who have recovered. And that means we get better in here, baby. We don't have to stay the same. And I went, whew, you know, because I didn't want to stay the same. I can tell you today that if my life wasn't absolutely everything that I wanted it to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, I might leave. You know, I know that I can have anything I want to have, I can do anything I want to do, and I can be anything I want to be in here with you guys. And it's only because I speak the same language and I follow a couple simple directions. But Paul took me through my steps. And he made me walk into the courthouse with like this many outstanding warrants and no money to pay them and go to the judge. You know, well, Your Honor, I'm an alcoholic and I'm 9 months sober. And, you know, time served and you get to go home. And that wasn't the way that it was supposed to be. And I can tell you that I know a lot of people that have walked into courtrooms and had that happen. I can also tell you that I know a lot of people who have walked into courtrooms that haven't had that happen. So I'm not going to promise you that that's going to happen for you, but that happened for me. You know, what I find in here is that my God is huge, and my God is as big as I want to allow Him to be in my life. And Paul died on my second AA birthday on the 10th of October in 86, and I thought my God died. And I'm going to tell you, that was a rough proposition for me. But I stayed anyway. I got another sponsor, and it was a female. And I can tell you, I learned more from that woman over the last, I don't know how many years, than anybody in my entire life. And she still lives down south. And I love her. And we've been through ups and downs and periods where I hated her guts and never wanted to talk to her again and didn't for like years. I'd sit across the table and pretend she didn't exist. And I was telling my friend on the way down here, now my karmic reaction for that is people do that to me. And I get to see how bad it sucks. So, you know, sorry, Connie. But, you know, what I get to do is I get to grow in here. I had an opportunity to go on a cruise at about 13 years sober, and I was all dressed up in my Saturday night banquet dress, and I looked pretty, and my husband was there, and we closed the casino on the ship, but that's another meeting. And and I was standing out on the side of the ship, you know, and I was looking at the moon, and it was reflecting off the waves coming off the ship, and there were a couple clouds, and it was just the most beautiful, surreal time I'd ever had in my life. And I felt like every one of those old-timers that have loved me so well were right there with me. And one of the drawbacks of getting sober in a club with a lot of old people, Burt's was known as the Dead Pecker Club all over the L.A. Basin. So one of the drawbacks from that is that they die. So I was standing on the ship, and I was looking at the moon, and I was talking to Paul Masson and Frank Priest and all of those people who loved me so incredibly, and I was telling them, whoever would have thought? You know, I knew for certain that I would never get a year. I would never be able to have a whole year sober. And here I'm, I got like 13 years sober, and I was heavily into my sixth and my seventh step because I didn't want to be like that anymore. And so I was telling them, look, you know, I had just done this humongous, like, Satan-sized list of character defects that were me. And I was standing there, and I was communing with my old-timers, and I realized all of them loved me, and it was really God that loved me. And just like I thought every one of them were standing there with me, it wasn't them after all, it was God. And all of those things on the list that I thought I wasn't anymore. And he had already taken them away. But I still wanted to think I was a badass. I still, you know, one of the women that I most related to and the first woman I wanted to be my sponsor when I was new was a member of the Manson family, and she had a little swastika on her forehead and had just come out of prison, and I was like, she's for me! You know, because that's how I identified myself. But today I walk with just a little bit of dignity and just a little bit of grace. And the thing that I want more than anything in my life is a conscious relationship with the God that you guys gave me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd love to tell you that that it's all work that I've done, and I've worked so hard, don't you know, and I've remained willing for all these years, and, you know. Most of the time, I do just enough to get me by, and I come in here and I learn from you guys. And what I know today is, when I'm uncomfortable, it's me. In step 10 and the 12 and 12, it says it's a spiritual axiom that every time I have a problem with something, it's me. It's not you. Anytime I find fault with anything, it's me. It's not you. And it tells me that is the spiritual axiom, the thing that everything rotates around. It's my problem. I am my problem. And it doesn't matter if I said that on the 10th of October in 84 or if I stand here tonight and still know that I am my problem. I'm my biggest, my one, and my only problem. But I come in here with you guys and I get to have a daily reprieve. I get to have a daily reprieve from the obsession to drink alcohol. I get to have a daily reprieve from going crazy on my kids. I get to have a daily reprieve from kicking my husband out of the house most of the time. You know, I just get a reprieve in here. And just like when I was new, or before I was new and I was drinking and I would go after that bottle and I'd go, I come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit down sometimes and I just get that, because this is home for me. You know, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want you to know, if you know nothing else, that you never, ever, ever have to pick up another drink for the rest of your life 24 hours at a time. And if you come in here and you want sobriety more than you want anything else, you can have it. And if you come in here and you keep sobriety your number one priority, you can keep it. And I stole that from Chuck C. All my goodies I stole from you. I got nothing original, you know. And Chuck, I heard say that a long, long time ago. that if sobriety is my number one priority, I can have it. And if it remains my number one priority, I can keep it. And I learned that when I was new in here. I learned that if I was absolutely and utterly destroyed and I came to you and said, how long do I have to come to these A&A meetings and hang out with you? And you told me once a day for the rest of your life, I was okay. You know, I was broken enough to be willing to do that. And I've remained that way. If you're new in here, stay here. You know, this is the easier, softer way. Everything that I have ever wanted in my life, I've attained in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to cry now, so I always wait till the last 2 minutes. My 18-year-old son just enlisted in my Navy. Is my next step done? I gave him my kit. I got to be done now, right? He's going to be a member of the Navy Special Forces of the Swift Boat Team, and he's going to boot camp next September. He's in delayed entry program. And my little 14-year-old guy's a starting quarterback for the Hollister Pop Warner Midgets. Woohoo! You know, he's a sports jock. He's the kid I hated in school. My husband and I have been married for a long time. I've been in a monogamous relationship for a long, 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 long time. You know, we've been together 16 years last New Year's Eve, and you know, it gets better. Everything gets better. My marriage is better. The daughter that I am is who I've always wanted to be for my mom. Who I am in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is who I need to be for you. And most of the time, it's got nothing to do with me. I just come in here and do what you guys did before. And I hope if you're not so new in here, you can remember some of those old-timers that were around when you were brand new that just loved you. Because I know that if I have no responsibility other than this, it is to just love you. And I never get to give up on somebody. And I like that about me. A lot of people go, you're wasting your time, and it says in the big book that. But you know what? I like that about me. Because I don't ever get to be the one that makes the decision, and I never know. Huh. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, beautiful. Thanks a lot. Next week's speaker is Gino H. from San Jose, and I want to thank I wish to thank all of those who participated tonight, and all of you for being here actually, and for helping us clean up after the meeting. May I please have two volunteers for rinsing the coffee pots? Thank you. Alrighty. How about some volunteers to stack the chair 7 high and don't drag them on the floor? Alrighty. Okay. And how about a couple more to take down the signs? Okay. Alright. Okay. Just remember who you are. Okay. Alrighty. After a moment, we'll have Rich take us home in the Lord's Prayer.
I had 2 more minutes.
I think she deserves another one. Yeah.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Keep coming back. It works.